He had short blonde hair, penetrating green eyes, and the whitest and straightest teeth Gene had ever seen. He pitched well in college and signed with the Dodgers after graduation. He threw hard. Too hard, as it turned out. Buck blew out his arm during the first year in the minors. He never pitched again. Buck's education and knowledge of the game motivated the Dodgers to keep him on as a pitching coach. He earned quite a reputation in the minors developing good young pitchers. When war broke out and it was apparent baseball was in trouble, the Dodgers put Buck in the Navy. His Columbia degree made him eligible to become an officer, which in turn allowed him to coach the Dodgers' new kids. Buck and Gene stepped out of the building and onto the pier. "Sure is a lot of water," Gene said, staring east across the lake. "Yes, it is," Buck answered. "A testament to the power of nature. Did you know this lake was carved by a glacier?" Buck paused, but Gene didn't respond. "So, Gene, I'm told you're quite the catcher." The Cesar boy shrugged. "I love to catch, and I love the game. It's my life." Buck laughed. "What's so funny?" asked Gene. "That's exactly what Frank Boudreau said you would say." "You know Frank?" Gene asked, excited at the mention of Frank's name. It was another link to his home on Mulberry Street. "Everyone knows Frank in the Dodgers organization. He signed me from Columbia University and has a reputation for being the very best at spotting talent. I shouldn't tell you this," continued the ensign, "but Frank says you're the best young catcher he's ever seen. But you need to know something. The guys you will be playing with over the next few months are also the best from wherever they are from. You'll have to play hard to compete, Gene, harder than you ever imagined. If you think playing with the Cesar Egyptian was competition, you haven't seen anything yet. Are you up to the challenge?" Gene stuck out his chin. "I'll do my best. I think I can hold my own." Buck looked him over and nodded. "Frank seems to think so, too." "Don't be too modest, and don't let Frank down. He hasn't stopped talking about you, so give it your best. There will be two other catchers you'll meet in a few days." He stopped and watched Gene's face. The boy from Cesar didn't seem to get it. "No one is guaranteed a spot on the team, Gene," Buck added. "You'll have to earn it."
"This team will have three catchers?"
Buck held his gaze. "No, Gene. It will have just two." Gene frowned. "What happens to the third guy?"
"He'll be cut from the team and will serve at the pleasure of Uncle Sam in the United States Navy."
Buck watched Gene nod slowly as the news sunk in. He reached out and grabbed the catcher's hand, gripping it tightly. "Remember, in front of the regular Navy guys, watch the Buck stuff. Call me Sir. Got it?"
"Aye, aye, sir," Gene responded with a big smile.
Buck laughed, gave Gene a little push, and said, "Go to bed. You're gonna need your rest." He turned and began walking down the pier, but stopped after a few steps. "Hey, Gene, have you ever caught a forkball?"
"No, but I know how the ball acts. It comes in hard and fast, then drops like a rock over the plate."
"Do we have someone who can throw it?" he asked.
"Oh, yeah. Ray Laws. He says when he's hot, catchers have as much trouble with his pitching as the batters do. Says he's never known a catcher who could catch him."
"That sounds like a challenge," Gene responded with a smirk. "He's never met me."
"You'll get your chance. We'll see if you can catch him in a few days. The other catchers say they can do it, too. Now go get some sleep."
Buck turned and began walking away again. This time he did not stop. Lost in his thoughts, Gene looked over the vast lake. For the first time in his life, he was faced with the prospect of not being the best. Everywhere, even in St. Louis, Gene had been the best overall ball player on the field and always a starter. Now the odds were 1 in 3 he would not make the team. It was a strange and unsettling feeling. "I can catch this Laws guy," Gene mumbled to himself. "I can catch anyone." He took one last look over the water.
"A glacier?" he thought. "What's a glacier?"
The next morning, Gene and the other recruits were moved to Great Lakes Naval Air Station just outside of Chicago. They were processed there and reported for swim testing on the first day of basic training. On the second day of basic, Gene was separated from the rest, taken to a barracks apart from the others, and met his teammates for the first time, his shipmates of the United States Navy Touring Baseball Team. Chapter 8. Team Navy. Gene walked out of the barracks and pulled his collar around his neck. It was cold in Chicago. The Great Lakes Naval Air Station was bigger than the entire town of Cesar. There were more people within a mile or two of where he stood than there were in all of Franklin County.
"Moore! Gene Moore! Over here!"
Gene saw Buck waving him over from across the road.
"Hey, Buck, what are we doing today?" Gene asked.
"We're going to see what our pitchers have and see how our catchers catch. Are you ready to play ball?" Gene smiled. "I was born to play ball. It's the last thing I think about before I fall asleep. It's the first thing I think about when I wake up. So yes," he laughed.
I'm ready to play ball and have been dying to get a mitt on again.
Well, let's grab a pitcher and see how you catch. Buck searched the group with his eyes until he found who he was looking for.
Hey, Wygant, grab your glove and get over here.
Bill Wygant nodded in acknowledgement and hustled over to Buck. Wygant was a short, stocky kid from Waterloo, Iowa. He was in high school when the war broke out and was being courted by the Dodgers. Like Gene, he was offered a spot on the Navy team and enlisted right away.
Bill Wygant, this is Gene Moore.
Bill and Gene shook hands.
Y'all warmed up? Asked Buck.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Good, let's play ball.
Buck ordered Bill out to the makeshift mound.
Let's see what you can do.
With that, he turned and walked away to begin matching other pitchers with the two remaining catchers. Gene squatted behind the plate, and Wygant planted a hard fastball into his mitt, over and over. He also had a curve that Gene really had to keep an eye on. In between pitches, Gene noticed Buck standing behind him off to one side, watching the duo perform. He had been so focused on Wygant, he failed to take note of the coach's arrival.
Bill, hold it, ordered Buck.
I'm going to switch catchers with you. Gene stood up, looked at Buck, and asked, Am I doing something wrong?
Nope, just switching catchers, answered Buck, who motioned for another player to join them.
Gene, this is Greg Pacer. Greg is a catcher from here in Chicago. Greg and Gene exchanged greetings and a handshake. Buck motioned for Gene to walk to where another player was standing.
Ray Laws, this is Gene Moore. Ray is from New Jersey.
Ray and Gene shook hands.
Ray,
Gene feels confident that he can catch your forkball. Ray gave a half laugh before answering.
I hope someone can.
He sure had trouble, tilting his head toward Greg, who was now catching for Wygant.
If you can throw it, I can catch it, Gene said with a smile.
Think so, huh? Ray asked in a skeptical voice.
If I can't catch it, I'll stop it. I don't let balls get past me.
As long as I keep the ball in front of me and within reach, no one will advance on me.
You ever catch a forkball before? Ray asked.
No, Gene responded. I've never even seen one, but I know what it does.
Ray looked over at Buck and shook his head.
I can tell my baby sister what it does, but it doesn't mean she can catch it.
Buck, isn't there a real catcher in the entire Navy?
Gene was taken aback by Ray's attitude.
I can catch you, Ray. Just pitch me a few and let's see, Gene shot back.
I'm through trying out catchers, Ray said, turning his head and spinning to the side.
Gene had heard enough. He glanced back at Buck and stepped closer to Ray, who turned back to look deeply into his dark eyes.
Are you as good at throwing that thing as you are at trying to make people feel incompetent?
No one had ever talked to Ray Laws that way before, something that was obvious from the look that crossed his face.
Yeah, I am that good at throwing it.
Neither player blinked.
Gene held the pitcher's steely gaze.
Then get your cocky ass 60 feet 6 inches away from me and let's see if you're half as good at baseball as you are at talking.
I'm hoping the further you get away, the more I'll like you.
Hey, Buck, I don't need this crap,
Ray replied. Buck was about to jump in when Gene stuck out his arm and cut him off.
This is between me and Ray.
Fair enough, answered the coach. Gene lowered his arm, but had never taken his eyes off of Ray's face.
Sorry, pal, but you do need this crap.
You can dish it out. Let's see how good you are.
Ray's eyes narrowed as he tried to size up this new kid from Southern Illinois.
Clearly, he had underestimated his fortitude. The kid continued speaking before he could formulate a clever comeback.
Buck lifted his hand to cover the grin spreading across his face.
Here's how I see it, Ray. If you want to pitch, you have to have someone catch.
You tell me no one can catch you?
Well, maybe you end up in a boat with the Japs shooting at you if no one can catch you. Have you ever thought of that?
While your target practice for Tojo, I'll be catching for someone else. I think it's really that simple.
I can catch your pitch, Ray. If you want to throw it well, that's your choice. If not, I'll find a pitcher who can do something besides whine.
Ray smiled, an ice-cold sneer that Gene found slightly unnerving.
All right, hotshot. Let's see if you can catch what I can bring.
You guys gonna talk or play ball?
Buck finally asked.
I'm already warmed up, Buck. I'm ready if he is, shot back Ray.
Go to the mound, then, and let's see this magic pitch of yours, Gene laughed.
Ray swaggered his way to the mound where he began rearranging some of the dirt with the toe of his right shoe.
Buck winked at Gene, folded his arm, and waited for the fireworks to begin.
Frank was right, he thought. This kid has a lot of heart.
Once he settled in, Ray looked at Gene, wound up, and let it fly. The ball didn't have a lot of spin and came in fast, really fast, right down the middle. As the ball crossed the plate, it dropped as if something had hit it. The ball hit the dirt, but Gene scooped it up without missing a beat. He held the baseball up and looked at it as if he'd never seen one before.
Well, I've never seen a ball do that.
Nice pitch. Ray caught the throw back to him and offered a grudging smile.
Nice catch, too. Let's see if that was beginner's luck.
It wasn't.
Ray threw another dozen pitches, and Gene, true to his word, caught, scooped up, or blocked every one. By this time, the two players were chattering back and forth like old friends who had been playing together since grammar school. Buck and several other players and coaches stood off to one side, watching the chemistry develop between Gene Moore and Ray Laws. "I think I like what I see," Buck said to another coach standing next to him. "Ray can make that ball dance, and Gene is handling it, no problem. I think this is going to be fun." Over the next few weeks, the team worked on physical training and practice games, while Buck assessed their talent and coached them onto basic skills. In the evening, they received training in military protocol and procedures. After all, they were in the Navy. The pitchers and catchers were separated from the rest of the team for a few days. It was apparent from the beginning that Gene was different. He was fundamentally sound and as good, if not better technically, than the other two catchers. But it was his understanding of the fundamentals of pitching and of pitchers as people that separated him from the rest of the pack. Gene was a player's player. He knew when to be funny, and he knew when to be serious. The pitchers gravitated to him. This team of up-and-coming raw talent was beginning to bond, and Gene was rapidly becoming their leader, both on and off the field. The Navy team continued to progress. Rarely was any mention of a war discussed, while the country mobilized its vast resources to fight a global conflict, producing equipment and supplies, training men to fight and women to work on the home front. Gene, Ray, and the rest of the team played baseball. They were lost in their love for the game and the obsession to play well. Most of the time, they had to remind themselves they were in the Navy, and their country was fighting a world war. Chapter 9, North Africa. Gene's life experiences were expanding faster than he'd ever dreamed possible. In the space of 2 years, he had gone from small-town catcher to the Brooklyn Dodgers organization and played ball with some of the best young prospects in the country. Now he was in the Navy in North Africa, a far cry from a one-hour hitchhiking trip home from St. Louis to Sesser. He knew nothing of Africa, except there were lions and elephants there, or at least he thought so. It had been several weeks since he set foot in the continent, and he still had not seen one single lion or elephant. There was, however, an enormous amount of military activity, plenty of sand, hordes of flies, and the occasional camel. The young Dodgers prospect landed in Africa in November 1942 as part of Operation Torch, a massive three-pronged naval invasion designed to open a second front against Nazi Germany. By the summer of 1942, Germany seemed unstoppable. Most of Europe had been overrun. German submarines, U-boats, were terrorizing the high seas, and England had barely survived a massive air assault. On June of 1941, Adolf Hitler lost a massive invasion of the Soviet Union nicknamed Operation Barbarossa. The Germans drove within sight of Moscow, where the early onset of winter and heroic defensive stand by the Red Army stopped the advance, saved the capital city, and kept Russia in the war. Another powerful German-Italian army under Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox, operated in North Africa. One of Germany's finest field commanders, Rommel, and his Africa Corps drove the British forces hundreds of miles east across the desert into Egypt. Rommel intended not only to defeat the enemy there, but to capture the precious oil fields that lay beyond. In an effort to dilute Nazi power and reverse the course of the war, the Allies decided to land in North Africa, defeat Rommel, and regain control of the Mediterranean Sea. General Dwight D. Eisenhower was appointed Allied commander of Operation Torch, one of the largest amphibious operations in world history. More than 100,000 French Vichy troops were stationed in Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. It was widely believed that these troops, which had cast their lot with Hitler's Germany, would not put up much, if any, fight against the Allies. The Allied landings began on November 8 in Casablanca, Oran, and Algiers. To the surprise of many, the French troops in Oran offered more than token resistance, but control of the landing areas was quickly gained and the beachheads firmly established. The United States landed 134,000 men onto the beaches of North Africa, together with tons of equipment, trucks, tanks, and gasoline, as well as baseballs, gloves, caps, and bats. The trip from the States to North Africa was anything but exciting. Gene had never seen the ocean before, but once he climbed aboard the transport ship, it was all he saw for 2 weeks. Endless tracts of empty sea stretched from horizon to horizon with nothing in between except other Allied ships cutting through the same blue-green swells. Like most of the men on board, it took Gene several days to find his sea legs and settle his stomach. The heaving sea and constant motion made it impossible to keep food or drink down for long. The hours spent hanging over the railing, retching into the sea, seemed to last forever. Once adapted to the endless ups and downs of a sea voyage, Gene and his teammates found walkways long enough to play catch, which broke the monotony and lifted their spirits. But there was no hitting and, of course, no games. Before arriving in North Africa, the convoy made a stop in the Azores, a Portuguese island chain 1,000 miles west of Africa, to drop off supplies and the baseball team. Gene and his teammates stayed there for about a month, practicing and preparing to play ball. For the rest of his life, he remembered how good it felt to feel solid ground under his feet and stretch his legs as he ran the bases. The team was picked up by another convoy and landed in North Africa in Casablanca, Morocco, as part of the western arm of the Naval Task Force. The beachhead was already well established by the time Gene arrived. It was now time for he and his teammates to complete their mission, playing ball for the troops. Gene discovered that sand does strange things to a baseball. There were no short hops in the infield. Once the ball hit the ground, it stopped, dead. Playing in the sand changed the entire nature of the game, but Americans loved baseball enough that entire crews of soldiers were assigned the task of doing whatever was necessary to construct ball diamonds at area military encampments. There was a war raging, and the United States had mobilized like never before in its history, but live without baseball? Not a chance. Where there were Americans, there was baseball. War or not, the game lived on, even in North Africa. The United States Navy Exhibition Baseball Team needed about 3 weeks before it was ready to play its first game. The fields were playable, the players were used to the sand, and they were back in shape after the debilitating sea journey. Buck assembled the team for a status report and addressed them. "Okay, men," he began. "The opposition, the U.S. Army Exhibition Team, should arrive tonight." The name of the opposition brought forth a stream of good-natured boos and hissing. Buck twisted a smile on his tanned face and raised his hands to calm the crowd. "Okay, okay. I really don't know how many times we'll be playing the same Army team. I don't know much about these guys, but we'll get to know them well, I'm sure." "Are they any good?" Ray Laws asked. I'm sure they are," answered the coach. "They're a team assembled just like we are. These are ball players who have tried out and made it into the major league organizations or were placed by a professional club on the team. So yes, I'm sure they're good." "Where are we going to play, Buck?" "Always here, or will we be moving around?" Gene asked. Buck shook his head. "I don't know. They want us close enough to the front to be able to bring troops out for a day of baseball and return them the same day. But we have to be far enough away not to put the troops or ourselves in the line of fire. War is new to me, too. The front, I hear, is pretty fluid, and so shifting up and back. I guess our field will, too. We'll travel with the portable backstop we built, but we must remain flexible and cooperative. Above all, remember that we are the sideshow, gentlemen. We are not, I repeat, not the main event. The war is why we're here, not baseball. If they are the Army team and we are entertaining Army troops, does that mean we're always the visiting team?" Tim Milner asked. "Good question. It would seem so, but no." He laughed as he reached down and lifted a wooden sign. He turned it around so everyone could read what was painted on the other side. Ebbets Field. The players cheered when they read the words. "We will alternate every day. The Army team is made up mostly of Yankee prospects, so they have a sign reading Yankee Stadium." Buck waited for the booing to subside. "Each day we will alternate by hanging our signs on the backstop. That will identify which team is home." Ron Calais, a 17-year-old center fielder from Houma, Louisiana, asked, "Are we in any danger here, Buck?" Ron's Cajun southern accent was so thick it was hard for most of the team to understand him when he spoke. "I'm sorry, Ron. Can you repeat the question?" "Are we in any danger here?" Ron said slowly and more deliberately. It was difficult to understand. "Well, yeah, I guess so. There is a war on. I have no idea how great our risk is, but sure. We're close to an enemy who is hell-bent on winning, commanded by one of the best the crowds have," Buck replied. Buck was calling on another player when a siren sounded. It started low and grew progressively louder and higher in pitch. He looked out the door and saw everyone outside running. A young soldier ducked his head into the barracks and yelled, "Air raid! Air raid! Follow me!" "I guess that answers your question," Buck shouted to Ron as the men headed for the door. The entire team ran through the door and followed the nameless soldier down a sandy path to a cave dug into the sand. Sandbags piled 10 high surrounded the doorway and were stacked on top of the makeshift bunker. They were squeezing their way into the hole in the ground when the seriousness of what was happening began to set in. The most visibly disturbed was Calais, who was sitting on Jean's left. His hands were shaking almost as bad as his voice when he suddenly asked, to no one in particular, "Are we gonna be okay?" Jean sensed a fear building, especially since they were all crammed underground, waiting to see what would happen next. A distant memory flooded into his mind from a time when he was still a small child. His father had herded the family into the cellar when it was reported that a tornado was spotted outside Cesar heading for the town. His father's calm voice had kept the family distracted and thinking about something else, and the danger passed them by. "Hey, everyone, I have a question.